recommend that to all of our members whenever I talk to them. Just because there isn't inherently a violation of the contract doesn't mean we don't care and doesn't mean that we won't try to help.
If you come out with $50,000, $100,000 of debt, okay, maybe that's possible to pay off over a couple decades. But if you come out with $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 worth of debt, at what point do we differentiate between indentured servitude and the system that we've set up?
But there is no evidence that we are seeing labor shortages be a widespread problem in the labor market. In fact, it's the opposite.
I was working at the International House of Pancakes, and I went to them and I said, I want to organize a union at the International House of Pancakes. And again, they took me under their wing and they told me what to do. And I got fired. I was like, holy shit, this stuff really works.
Ultimately, we hear a story about two local three electricians working together on a job site. It just happens to come up. Yeah, I'm going to need a kidney. And another brother says, I'll get tested. Didn't even think twice. They were a match and they were able to share that bond.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Can your boss actually do that? What workplace legal protections do you have if you're not covered by a union contract? On the Working to Live in Southwest Washington podcast, hosts Shannon and Harold sat down with Diana Winter, attorney for IBEW Local 48. On the AFT Connecticut podcast, we meet State Representative Josh Elliott, who discusses the costs of higher education in the Nutmeg State. The Economic Policy Institute's podcast, The State of Working America, is back, and none too soon, as EPI staffers fact-check the labor shortage hype. Then, on the Blue Collar Gospel Hour, author and activist Sue Blaustein remembers her earliest days in the labor movement and describes what it's really like to be a food safety inspector. Finally, a touching story on the Union Strong podcast from the New York State AFL-CIO as we meet fifth-generation electrical worker Chris Erickson, who donated a kidney to his brother in 2017 and changed the way members of his local thought about live organ donation. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Remember, you can find all of today's shows along with more than 100 more just like them at laborradionetwork.org. And if you enjoy the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, be sure to like us and share. Solidarity works. Here's the show.
Listening to episode number 19 of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council and sponsored by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48. We're also a proud member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with over 100 radio shows and podcasts for working people just like you. Find out more about the network at laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Shannon Myers.
And I'm Harold Phillips.
We've brought on a couple of experts on labor law for this episode, so you, our audience, can know what to watch for in your workplace.
So let's start with Diana Winter, General Counsel at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48. Thanks so much for joining us, Diana.
Happy to be here, Harold and Shannon.
And as a disclaimer, I just want to let the audience know, Diana is one of my best friends in the whole wide world. I'm so glad you're here, Diana.
Oh, another disclaimer. We're full of disclaimers on this show. So a lot of people don't know much about labor law. Can you give us some examples of some misconceptions about labor law that you've run into in your career?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that employment law and labor law are interchangeable. There certainly can be some overlap, but those are not inherently the same things. For example, I'm a labor lawyer. My client, as you mentioned before, was IBEW Local 48. And so I advise them about things that are specific to labor law and labor unions. I talk about grievances, which is when there's been a violation of the contract that our members are working under. I help with negotiations for contracts. I also, on occasion, help them with what are called unfair labor practices. Those are violations of the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act. That's specific to labor law, labor unions, the requirements for unions and for employers that have organized employees. Employment law can cover a lot of other things that don't necessarily intersect with labor law. For example, if you are not an organized worker, you don't have a contract, your employer is therefore not going to violate your contract because you don't have one. But they could still, as you were mentioning earlier, violate the law about whether you're getting paid minimum wage, whether you're getting paid overtime like you should be, whether or not you're being sexually harassed or discriminated at work. Now, some contracts have language that touch upon employment law issues. For example, a lot of contracts will have a statement in there that says the employer agrees to abide by all federal, state, and local laws. So if there is an employment law that's violated and your contract has that language in it, then your union could potentially grieve, which is mean this part of the contract is violated, and have a grievance with your employer about that. But not all contracts have that.
So, Diana, you mentioned a safe workplace, and we know that during the year that's just passed, safety was a major concern that a lot of employees had in their workplace. If someone feels like their employer isn't making safety a top priority, what legal remedies do they have?
So it probably depends on what the safety concern is. If it's something that's managed by state law, there's going to be the occupational health and safety at the state level, and there's also federal. So it sort of depends on where you're working and what applies to you. In Washington, there's also the labor and industries. So that's a point of contact for workers if they feel like they are having safety issues. Certainly, there's been a number of complaints filed by workers regarding safety concerns about COVID exposure and those sorts of things. And really, occupational safety and health is the folks that are most likely to be in charge of enforcing that. Now, if you're a represented worker, you most certainly should reach out to your union as well. Just because your union doesn't necessarily have language about COVID in your contract or in a memorandum of understanding, because Lord knows a lot of unions did additional documentation that's binding, so there could be a violation of those new rules. But even if there isn't something like that in place, call your union. I always recommend that to all of our members whenever I talk to them. Just because there isn't inherently a violation of the contract doesn't mean we don't care and doesn't mean that we won't try to help. Doesn't mean we can't have a conversation with your employer to try to figure out what's going wrong and how it can be fixed.
I just hope the listeners now know why I love Diana.
How can you not? I just want to say thank you, Diana Winter, General Counsel at IBEW Local 48.
It was a pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to AFT in Action, a podcast for members of AFT Connecticut affiliated local unions. We're approximately 30,000 working people in the public and private sectors, teachers and school support staff, nurses and healthcare workers, higher education faculty and public employees in nearly 90 unions across the state.
Welcome, sisters and brothers, to another episode of AFT in Action. My name is Jan Hockadell, your State Federation President, and once again, co-hosting this latest episode. Today, we're going to be talking about preserving students' public higher education and how community colleges are being impacted here in Connecticut. And I'm so pleased to have Dennis Boguski, AFT Connecticut's Divisional Vice President for Higher Education and the International Student Advisor from Nora Community College, to co-host this session with me. And so, Dennis, in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of talk about the plans to consolidate the community colleges in an effort to reduce the cost. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
It was presented as a way to stop dwindling existing reserves. It was not the program that's out there today. It was presented as, look, we're spending our reserves, you know, too quickly, and we're going to run out of reserves. So we want to, in a sense, right-size the institutions, looking at back office functions and things like that. There was some resistance to that because of some of the things that came out. And then all of a sudden, our institutions needed a whole major overhaul. according to this plan and according to the management group. This does not have an ounce of faculty buy-in or staff buy-in, and it's had resistance all the way along. I always end with saying, students first has a nice ring to it, but this isn't students first.
Thank you, Dennis, for all you do and for agreeing to co-host this with me today. And to join us in our conversation, we have State Representative Josh Elliott, who represents the 88th District in Hamden, and he is the co-chair of Connecticut's Higher Education Committee, and I have to say, a strong supporter of organized labor. And we are so fortunate to have him here with us to talk about these discussions that are happening in the legislature, the consolidation and funding for higher education. So welcome, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
So can you just share some of your experiences this past year with the Higher Ed Committee?
I did not ask for higher ed specifically. I told leadership, listen, I am ready. I came in with my elbows out. I repaired all those relationships over the past few years. I still have my moral compass firmly in place, and I'm working better with my colleagues. Give me a chance to run a committee. And Speaker Ritter said, okay. So he gave me a slate of a few options, and higher ed was clearly the one that made the most sense for me to choose. And he said, I'll give you a couple of days to think about it. And I said, nope, I don't need to think about it. I'm good. Give me higher ed. That's great. Let's do it.
Why did it make sense to you?
My policy agenda is heavily geared towards criminal justice reform and voting access, and also good accounting, good transparency, good government in terms of ensuring that the wealthy pay their fair share and that we have good and clean elections. Those are my big priorities. But aside from that, I know a lot about my generation and the overwhelming debt that people come out with, and seeing people's salaries decline over time, or at least not gain as much as the ultra wealthy have. And I also know that the cost of education has been going up every single year for decades. So we are on this slow train ride to the system falling apart. We saw it in 2008, 2009 with housing. I assume at some point we'll see it with credit card debt, but we're absolutely going to see it with debt for colleges. I was well aware of this problem for the last decade or so, because at a certain point, the way that I phrase it is, you know, if you come out with $50,000, $100,000 of debt, okay, maybe that's possible to pay off over a couple decades. But if you come out with $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 worth of debt, at what point do we differentiate between indentured servitude and the system that we've set up? If you're in debt over the course of your entire life because there's simply no way to pay that money off, these are a result of choices that we've made, both at the Capitol and at the Capitol in D.C. And broadly speaking, I know the kinds of problems that we need to be working on in the Higher Education Committee.
That's fantastic. As an educator, I thank you. And as a mother of a child who has her doctorate, but is going to be paying huge amounts of money until she's 55 years old, I also appreciate your viewpoint. So thank you twice. We are so appreciative of your knowledge, your views, and the experience in the legislature, and that all you do for the working people in Connecticut, Josh.
That's a wrap for this latest edition of AFT in Action. Additional episodes are available at our Podbean page and social media channels, all of which can be found at aftct.org. Like what you heard? Then share with fellow members and encourage they give it a listen too, and help build the power of the you and I in union.
Welcome to the State of Working America podcast, where we strive to provide a reality check of how workers from all walks of life are impacted by the economy and what needs to be done to address workplace inequalities. Today, we're taking on a contentious topic right now, the labor shortage. I'm Eve Takangiolu. I'm the Communications Director for the Economic Policy Institute, known as EPI. With the economy finally opening up, many businesses, particularly in the restaurant industry, are saying they can't find enough workers. We're here to figure out the real scope of the problem and also to shine some light on why help wanted signs are staying up a little longer lately. To make sense of what's really happening, we have two of the Economic Policy Institute's labor market gurus, Josh Bivens, EPI's Director of Research, and Heidi Scherholz, Senior Economist and Director of Policy. Welcome, Josh and Heidi. I'm so glad that you've joined us today to put this all in perspective. And let's jump right into it. I mean, how big of an issue are labor shortages right now?
It's a really good question. And the bottom line answer is we are not seeing widespread labor shortages. We do not see the widespread acceleration of wage growth that you would expect if we were experiencing significant labor shortages. And I just think it's useful to think about why wage growth is the footprint in the data of a labor shortage. And that's just, if I'm an employer and I can't get the workers that I need, I will raise wages to attract, to poach workers from other employers, and then they will raise wages to retain their workers, and on and on. So that's what you see if there is a labor shortage. We are not seeing that in a widespread way, but we are seeing it in some isolated sectors, namely leisure and hospitality. So that in that sector, over the last few months, we have seen wages accelerate. As leisure and hospitality is reopening more broadly, employers have had to raise wages to attract the workers that they need. But the really important context there, and it sort of gets at this question of, are wages in leisure and hospitality too high? The answer to that is just a resounding no. What we have seen in leisure and hospitality is that in order to attract workers, employers have had to raise wages from their extremely low levels that prevailed during the worst of the COVID pandemic. So if you look at what happened to wages in leisure and hospitality, and that's where restaurants are, they plummeted during the worst of the recession. They have accelerated in the last 3 months, but only to roughly what you'd expect them to be if COVID had never happened. So we are seeing some of that tightening in leisure and hospitality, but there is no evidence that we are seeing labor shortages be a widespread problem in the labor market. In fact, it's the opposite. There are just not enough jobs available right now for people who need them.
So if we do start to see some tightening, serious tightening in the economy, that often leads to inflation concerns. Lately, we've been hearing a little bit about inflation rearing its head, but should we be fearful of that, Josh? Is that an issue now or something we should be looking for?
So it is definitely not an issue now. I mean, I would say price inflation that is driven by like really broad-based wage growth that is too fast, wage growth in excess of economy-wide productivity growth for a really long period of time. Yeah, that's definitely one thing macroeconomic policymakers, particularly the Fed, worry about appropriately.
And that's the Federal Reserve, right?
Yes.
Josh?
That's right, Federal Reserve. Essentially, the Fed is always trying to balance the benefits of ever lower unemployment and higher pressure labor markets against the risks that these high pressure labor markets, really low unemployment, are going to generate excess wage growth and eventually lead to price inflation. But for way too much of recent decades, macro policymakers and the Fed have gotten this trade-off really badly wrong. They've either engineered or tolerated unemployment rates really far in excess of what's needed to keep inflation tame. So in coming years, you know, what we need to see is a lot of forbearance from the Federal Reserve, switching from a regime where they basically say, we're going to stomp on inflation before it even happens. We're going to get ahead of the curve and raise rates before inflation is even in the data. Instead, thinking about this in terms of we're going to take on some risk. We're going to tolerate some periods where prices or wages are actually growing kind of fast because we think that'll be transitory. We think the benefits of the really low unemployment and the better bargaining power will be large for workers. And I think that's the regime they're taking steps toward, to their huge credit, under, you know, Ben Bernanke and then Janet Yellen and now Jerome Powell. There's just been an increasing willingness of the Fed to realize that they have probably let unemployment be too high for too long, and they're actually going to take on a little bit of risk time because it's been decades since we've seen a problematic period of inflation.
So thank you to both of you, Josh and Heidi. Thanks so much. Josh Bivens and Heidi Scherholz joined us from the Economic Policy Institute, where Josh is a director of research. Heidi's a senior economist and director of policy. To hear more of EPI's podcasts, go to epi.org/podcasts. Also make sure to read our latest research by going to epi.org and follow us on social media to find out about new podcasts and a whole lot of other stuff at Economic Policy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Blue Collar Gospel Hour. I'm your host, Dan Denton. I'm here tonight virtually from Not a Duck in Any Row Studios in Toledo, Ohio, with my guest, Sue Blaustein. Did I say your name? Sue, yeah. Blaustein, from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She is a retired food safety inspector, and I met her virtually because she's a poet and a writer. And the more that I have gotten to know about Sue, now, first of all, I was a fan of some of her poetry, and the poetry was so interesting that I wanted to know more about Sue, and we got to be Facebook friends, and here we are. Everybody, welcome Sue Blaustein. How are you, Sue?
I'm good.
Good. Thanks for being willing to be a guest on my podcast. I really appreciate it. You're not from Milwaukee. You grew up on the East Coast.
That's right. I grew up in New York City, in Queens, and then the migration started. I've been in Wisconsin since 1974. Because I came to Madison just before I turned 19. I stayed there for 5 years, moved to Milwaukee in 1979, and I've been here in Milwaukee ever since.
When you were growing up in Queens, did you ever dream of living in Milwaukee? Is that what you planned to do, or?
No, nobody makes that plan. Okay, how did I get to Milwaukee? Now starts the first. How do I get to Madison? My older sister went to college. She was studying, among other things, she had a class in classical Chinese literature in translation and shared some of the things she was reading. And it really appealed to me. So my plan was to become a translator of classical Chinese poetry. I was also reading stuff like the Dharma Bums and Gary Snyder. This is 1970, and that stuff was really hot at that time. And that's how I ended up in Madison in the East Asian Language and Literature Department. But two things happened. I met a lot of people in radical politics. Some of them were in the Chinese language department because China was a beacon at that time. And there was just a lot of stuff going on in Madison. Those were the final years of the Vietnam War. And a lot of the people I met turned out to be communists, and they took me under their wing. So I went from Queens to Madison with the idea of being like a hippie academic, translating Chinese poetry. I also knew at that point, I don't think I was cut out for an academic career. I was far from even getting a bachelor's degree, and I couldn't see staying in school. Anyhow, I was taken under the wing of a lot of mentors in Madison and got introduced to trade unionism by some women that were organizing a union in a restaurant. And they were feminist union organizers. And they wrote this big article in the Daily Cardinal in Madison about how people in the service industry should have the right to stand up for themselves, not to be abused. They were really ahead of their time. And I read that and I'm like, whoa. And I was working at the International House of Pancakes, and I went to them and I said, I want to organize a union at the International House of Pancakes. And again, they took me under their wing and they told me what to do. And I got fired. I was like, holy shit, this stuff really works. You talk to a few people about a union and the next thing you know, they're taking you off the schedule. And that made me like a real hot little protege among these people I was meeting. And it was just from there, it was just defined the rest of my life, really.
So working as a food safety inspector, what was your day-to-day life like? Did you have a company car? Did you check into an office first thing in the morning, then head out?
Yeah, we checked into the office in the morning. We drove our own cars. We got reimbursed for mileage. And like I said, for a period of 18 months to 2.5 years, you had a district assignment. And when I started in the early 90s, they gave you a paper list. This is your district list. And it listed the places you had to inspect. And we had a different timetable. Some places, like if it's a tavern that doesn't sell food other than beer, nuts, and chips, it only has to be inspected once a year. If it's a restaurant with more complex activities, then it had to be, depending on what our policy was at any given time, it had to be inspected twice a year or three times a year. And then we would write orders, what the violations from the food code were, what to do to correct them, and follow up on. So you would either be making an initial visit in any given day or a follow-up visit to see if there was compliance with your orders. And you had a lot of discretion. So here's your work, do it. We didn't have a supervisor giving you a trip sheet for the day. Once you have a district, so that's your work. And you do it. You make cold calls. They don't know when you're going to come. Everybody sees this huge mystique about, oh, they don't know you're coming. After a while, it's at inspector. Nobody, they know. It's part of the deal when you get a food license that you're going to be open your premise to inspection. So there's not as much of a thrill about the inspector showing up after a while. I think sometimes people's imaginations about what goes on behind the scenes, it's not, yeah, you're going to find some stuff that's definitely needs immediate correction. People like, oh, I bet you they spit on it. They do it. They drop it on. It's not as sinister, I think, as a lot of people think.
Yeah.
But it's, to me, what I like about the job, again, as a writer, is really the essence of the job is communication. And the other thing is, I love science. And that pervades the book, too. It's from my, I love science. And like food inspection is like popular science. People have determined, real scientists have determined how to kill pathogens and this and that, and what to do. And then you're like translating it. And well, this process, what happens when this process doesn't work? If people haven't seen this year in COVID, what happens with public health messaging when it all, this is not news to people who are in public health, but it's like the worst case scenario coming true over and over and over.
Sue, thank you so much for joining me. Everybody, check out www.sueblaustein.com. There will be links posted with the episode on social media. Buy Sue's books, support her work, and help make the world a better place.
For the New York State AFL-CIO, I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. Have you ever thought about becoming an organ donor?
The major organs that are listed in the New York State Donate Life Registry that people would be consenting to are heart, liver, lung, pancreas, intestines, and kidneys. So one organ donor can save up to 8 lives if they were able to use all of those organs.
Tissue donations occur after the organ donor has died, but in some cases, organs are donated while the donor is alive. That was the case for Chris Erickson Jr., who's a member of the International Union of Electrical Workers, IBEW Local 3. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Darcy.
So, Chris, how long have you been a member of IBEW Local 3?
I've been a member since 2007, so about 14 years now. And I'm a fifth generation Local 3 IBEW member.
That's fantastic. So we've been talking about organ donation, and most organ and tissue donations occur after the donor has died. Some organs and tissues can be donated while the donor is alive, and that's where your story comes in. Chris, can you tell me about your own personal experience?
Sure. I've been a living donor. I donated a kidney back in 2017, and it's a pretty interesting story that unfortunately isn't necessarily unique because there's so many people in need of an organ donation. But luckily enough, we were able to handle it within our family. And unfortunately, that isn't always the case. But back years ago, my younger brother was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease while he was in high school. And at the time, he was able to manage that with diet and exercise and medication. But ultimately, we knew that he was going to need a kidney donation because slowly but surely, the kidney function was diminishing. Mm-hmm. So in 2017, we had the time was starting to come close. My father, Chris Erickson, who was the business manager of Local 3, he had gotten tested. And our family decided he was going to be the one to donate the kidney. But unfortunately, we ran into a bit of a roadblock when he was ruled out because of some medication he was on unrelated to anything specifically with his kidney. The doctors decided he wasn't the best option for Thomas. We had to call an audible at that point. Myself and my other younger brother, Robbie, we both got tested. We were both matches, which was a relief. And we joke about it. We say we had one of the most ultimate games of rock, paper, scissors to decide who was going to donate a kidney. But I was a little bit of a better match. And we knew down the road, Thomas may ultimately need another kidney donation because of the disease. It never goes away. At that point, it was decided that I was going to be the one to donate my kidney to Thomas.
It's your brother. I'm sure, obviously, you love your brother. You want to help him. How is he doing today?
Yep, everything worked out really well with him. The recovery time in the hospital, it's a little bit harder of a recovery on the donor in terms of the physical, you're beat up a little bit more. And, you know, once he had the new kidney and it's up and functioning and everything, he feels like $1 million because all of a sudden he's got a perfectly functioning kidney. And within a week after the surgery, I'm still hobbling around my apartment and he was at a Fish concert.
Wait a minute. That doesn't sound fair. I don't know, Thomas. Yeah. Maybe he should have canceled that concert plan just for you.
That's okay. He's going funny. No matter what. And I was glad.
That's great. And in your case, you just explained donating a kidney to your brother, a family member. But I've heard at your local, you've had other union members who have donated to their coworkers. Is that right?
Yes. The one thing about this happening to our family is that it became a very public topic. My father was able to discuss this at union meetings with 1,000 Local 3 members in the room, talking about going through this process. And that's the biggest thing that people going through this can have, to hear that other people are going through similar circumstances. And then all of a sudden, after the meeting, a member comes up and says, oh, my cousin's going through the same thing, or my sister needs a kidney. And ultimately, we hear a story about two Local 3 electricians working together on a job site. It just happens to come up. Yeah, I'm going to need a kidney. And another brother says, I'll get tested. Didn't even think twice. They were a match and they were able to share that bond because one Local 3 brother didn't know him from, you know, Adam. And he said, I'll get tested, was a match and donated his kidney.
That's fantastic. And yeah, we're talking about union brothers and not siblings here, but that is incredible that someone would do that. And people do that. I was getting chills when you were explaining that. It's the feeling after, I think you were saying it, you wake up, right? And knowing that you've done something like that for someone. Chris Erickson Jr., what a wonderful gift you've given your brother and a beautiful story, really. I want to thank you for sharing your story with us.
I appreciate it. And that's the best part about it, being able to talk about it and shine light on something that people are going through and see if you can help them and make differences in people's lives.
Yeah, you're an inspiration. Thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
that'll do it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 Labor Radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produced the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us, in what we do, on Twitter, Instagram, at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. We really hope you enjoy the show, and we also hope it inspires you to explore the shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 100 across the country and indeed around the world, ordinary folks who are working hard to air the voices of workers. If you do, please help spread the word about this amazing and growing world of labor radio and podcast shows. Like the show and share it on social media. Sonic solidarity, if you like. Thank you very much for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. This is Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.